Good afternoon. Welcome to the December meeting of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience, reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. This is the 405th meeting of the forum and comes to you today from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, the president of the forum. The forum was founded in 1983 and is now in its 35th year of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum is honored today to have Stephen Harder speaking on a U.S.-China partnership. Stephen Harder is a global adjunct professor of law at New York University in Shanghai, where he teaches courses in international law and institutions, comparative constitutions, and the international investment in developing countries. He has been a partner at the global law firm of Clifford Chance since 1995, has been the managing partner of the firm's mainland China practice since 2002. His recent practice has focused on cross-border financial transactions between China and other nations, such as Russia and countries in Africa and South America. During his career, Mr. Harder has been based in New York, Brussels, Warsaw, Moscow, Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Beijing. When based in Europe in the early 1990s, he was a legal counsel for the Russian and Polish mass privatization program, as well as counsel to the Polish government in its London Club's foreign debt negotiations. Among Mr. Harder's publications is an article on China's sovereign wealth fund, The Need for Caution, which appeared in the International Financial Law Review. He has spoken in recent years at U.S. law schools and business schools on China in the balance, needed reforms, vested interests, and the choices facing China's leaders. Mr. Harder has a bachelor's degree in Chinese studies from Princeton University, an MBA from the Columbia Graduate School of Business, and a law degree from Columbia Law School. He is a native of Boston and, when not traveling the world, is a resident of Rockport, Maine. Mr. Harder, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you very much, George. It's wonderful to be here, so close to our home in Rockport and my mother's home in Camden. Yorkchi and I have brought up our three children all over the world, and particularly in China, but every summer of the year they're here, and every winter for some weeks during Christmas holidays. And for them, Maine is America, and I think that's a very nice thing for them. I'd like to correct the title today. It says China-U.S. Partnership. I'd like to add a question mark at the end, China-U.S. Partnership, and I think that's a very important question mark. My work in China over the last 20 years has been helping international companies to partner with Chinese companies in Chinese cities, working side by side with them, but also, particularly in the last 10 years, working with the Chinese to partner and to invest overseas, particularly the China Development Bank, perhaps the most important development bank in the world now, and also the China Investment Corporation, the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund, as they invest in Europe, in Russia, in Africa, and Asia, as George said. When one thinks about partnering, I think it's always a good idea that each partner get a good sense of who the other partner is. And so what I'd like to talk about today is my sense of what China is as a partner for the United States, and to ask ourselves from the Chinese point of view what the U.S. looks like as a partner to China, and then work through a couple of the implications of that for the future. So China, it's a world to itself. We see a wonderful map in front of us of China, which many people have seen. And there's some things about China that I think are less frequently commented on, but a very important part of China's strength. The language of China, the Chinese language, which enables a country of as many different dialects as Europe all to speak the same and to read the same language, is terribly important. And also what's important, that's a horizontal aspect of the language that connects a country as large as Europe. But vertically, Xi Jinping, the president of China, if he wishes to, can open a book of Confucius and read the same characters and understand what Confucius was writing. That's a vertical unity of the language that goes back 2,000 years. It's also very computer friendly. If you're on the Shanghai subway and you see the flying fingers of teenagers typing Chinese into their mobile phones, you'll know that, that Chinese is no impediment to the computer age. So that's a very important strength of China. And then in terms of culture, unlike many developing countries which are riven by racial or religious fissures in those societies, China, for most of China, not the western provinces, not Tibet and Xinjiang and Qinghai, but for most of China, the ethnic mix is 94-95% Han Chinese. There aren't the religious differences that, that torment India and other countries. And the other thing about Chinese culture, which is so deep, is the desire to learn. It is extraordinary when you're meeting with Chinese government officials how much they are trying to learn from other countries and from learn from the practices of other countries. It's an amazing aspect of the culture. To mention Confucius one more time, the last time today, the very first word in the very most important Chinese classic, xue, is the Chinese word for to learn. It's the very first word. It's sort of like in the Bible, in the beginning in Chinese, in the beginning is learning. And of course, I think most people have a sense of how strong family connections are and a belief in meritocracy. The other thing about China that informs someone from Xi Jinping to any intelligent, educated person in China is that their classics are a humane source of strategy. They talk about humane government, the responsibilities of government, of the rulers, and they also talk about strategy. And they also contain a vision of greatness, which is part of Chinese culture and is renewing itself now. Another huge strength of the potential partner of the United States is the diaspora that the Chinese have. Chinese have in Singapore and Taiwan and Hong Kong, and not least of all in the United States, have the Chinese nation has the advantage of Chinese overseas who know these other cultures, who've succeeded, who bring skills and their commitment and their energy back to China in a way that's very important for Chinese development. And finally, obviously, we know China is a large country, but the implication of that, I think James Madison would have understood, because he felt that very large countries, they broke faction. They made it very difficult for one faction to overcome another. And I think there's a kind of Madisonian stability that now exists in China. The same difficulties that might have produced warlords in the 20s and 30s actually now prevent warlords in China. Prevent the equivalent of warlords in China because it's just too big. The other remarkable thing about China is that it has created a new model of political economy that we have never seen before in the world, never. We have a country that has, over the last 30 years, allowed markets to function. It is essentially a free market economy for prices. Much of China is private enterprise and enormously entrepreneurial private enterprise. But at the same time, the largest and most important companies in China, to a large extent, are state-owned. And many of them you may have invested in because they're listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And so what does that mean if they're state-owned but listed on the New York Stock Exchange? What it means is that the Chinese government has kept 75% of the ownership of these companies, but allowed about 25 or 30% to be listed for the public. Why is that such a brilliant thing to do? It's because many of the disadvantages of state-owned companies are thereby mitigated. The advantage of listing is that these companies are now, they must account to the market, they must disclose their business situation, their price is available to the market. They are also forced to compete because when the Chinese created and coalesced these large state-owned enterprises, often from multiple provincial enterprises, they didn't coalesce them into one. They usually coalesce them into two or three. There are three major telecom companies in China that compete with each other like mad. There are many different steel companies. There are three major petroleum companies. They compete with each other, but they're all owned by the Chinese government. And what that produces is many of the advantages of a market economy and a competitive system, but it also allows the government to manage the economy in some ways that are simply not possible in another country. There's another aspect of the Chinese political economy which explains to some degree how powerful the government is when it seeks to direct it. And that is that for during Mao's time, for about 30 years, the secret of China, despite being a great socialist country in their own mind and in the mind of many people in the West, was that actually they were taking wealth from the peasants and giving it to the urban residents. There was a kind of financial repression that went on in the pricing system from the farms to the cities. In the last 30 years, a different kind of financial repression has taken place because the Chinese putting their money in the three or four major Chinese banks put it in at a very low interest rate. They earn a very low interest rate on their money. The banks are allowed to lend it out at a much higher interest rate, building in almost a spread of 3 or 4%. And that has created enormously profitable and huge Chinese state-owned banks, which have a lot of money to lend. Also, China has capital controls. The Washington model told all the countries in Southeast Asia, you should let capital flow freely across your borders. It's much better that way. And when the Asian financial crisis occurred, it almost ruined several of those countries. China has capital controls, and therefore the government can control foreign exchange coming in and out. And finally, of course, the government is able to direct companies to go in a certain strategic direction, to acquire copper in Latin America, to acquire oil or oil interests in Africa, to go out, as the Chinese say, zhou chu qu. And this has been something going on for 20 years, which has had enormous strategic implications. So what is driving this is another aspect of China, which is also essentially unique now in the world, and that is the party state. There are a few vestigial Marxist states, Cuba, North Korea, and so forth, but China is perhaps the only Leninist capitalist country that the world has ever seen. The party has unchallenged authority to rule, but in taking that unchallenged authority to rule, they believe they have responsibility to govern. The senior leaders of the Chinese party wake up every morning asking themselves how they are to govern. And that is a very important aspect, I think, of the Chinese mentality at the top. Almost universally, when business people from the United States go to China, they are impressed with the senior government officials they meet. And I believe they're impressed with them because these officials have had 20 or 30 years of experience in many different situations governing, deciding what are the right things to do. They're not distracted by having to constantly signal to each other in language what is the current issue of the day, which actually can preoccupy politics in a Western country. Another thing is that China is a policy state. And I think that America, in many ways, to compare, is a more of a rights state. And what I mean by that is that when you think about how a major company or a major institution, anything from the U.S. Army to a great university, to a great hospital, when they adjust to the world, they make a policy. If the policy doesn't work, they change the policy. In a rights system, if you're looking at the world, you decide you want new legislation and you hand out rights and entitlements, which are very difficult to change. And what a policy state is able to do is very flexibly experiment and try out different things and to be pragmatic. The flip side of that, of course, is if the policy changes, individuals may be hurt in a way that they find unjust or intolerable in many ways, and therefore there's a potential for brutality. But at the same time, there's a great advantage in terms of flexibility. Another difference in the party state is because the people who are governing are in the party their whole lives, and moving from provincial governor to head of company and so forth, they have a very long-term vision. And you know that when you meet them. Another flip side of that, however, is the power can translate into riches. For the last 30 years, people who've been in high positions of government in China, their families have become very rich. And our first instinct, perhaps, is to say, well, that is a kind of corruption. But there are many different kinds of corruption, and if you want to use that word. And most of the riches of the families of senior leaders in China, most of them, are derived from having inside information, of knowing where the subway line is going to go, knowing where the company IPO is going to go. And the family members are often quite intelligent and quite driven people, and they derive their riches from that. Of course, there are other kinds of corruption which are much more insidious, which we could talk about later. The final strength, I think, in terms of governance in the party state is the collective leadership. When you think about it, the standing committee the seven men. It's never been a woman on the standing committee yet. The standing committee, seven people have different portfolios. Yes, there's often been a dominant figure on that committee, and this time around is Xi Jinping. But seven people taking the portfolios to govern an important country, I think is in many ways a much stronger position to be in. And Xi Jinping, in many ways, epitomizes this leadership class in China. His father, Xi Zhongxun, was a very important and actually very beloved official. From the age of 12 to 22, Xi Jinping was sent down to the countryside under very difficult conditions during the Cultural Revolution. But as soon as he got back and went to university, his father placed him afterwards as the personal secretary of the head of the military commission. That's like being the personal secretary of our chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he did that for 3 years. Imagine what he learned in that position. Imagine how close he is to the military now. And after that, from the years I think he was about 18 or so until 54, he only spent seven of those years in Beijing. Most of that time was in Fujian and other places. He knows the country. And he has a kind of confidence and a strength of personality, which I think has been widely remarked upon. And he has centralized power in a way that we haven't seen really ever in China. Even Mao, during some of Mao's time, did not have the control over the government that Xi Jinping has. He's really become the dominant leader, coming out of the 19th Party Congress, just concluded last week. So is this a behemoth that's also unstoppable in all these strengths? Of course not. China has tremendous challenges facing it. Huge amount of debt was pumped out into the economy to stimulate it during the financial crisis. There's an enormous migration from the rural areas into cities. Hundreds of millions of people over several decades have moved into the cities in China. And they still have not sorted out a kind of internal passport called the Hukou, which prevents rural residents, when they move into a city, from having the benefits of education or health care that the city residents have. And of course, pollution is terrible in China, air, water, land, and they are facing a real crisis of demography. The one-child policy has resulted in two things, a sex imbalance, male and female, that's quite dramatic in certain age cohorts, also a declining workforce. The workforce in China has been declining by millions over the last few years and will continue to do so. And in fact, the population of China will cap out and begin to decline in the middle of the century. And of course, the minority regions are a real tension for China. I spoke to a friend who's involved in the foreign affairs ministries in China recently, and he said that in Xinjiang, in the far west, where the Uyghur people are about half the population of 20 million, that the police stations there are like forts. And there have been some very great difficulties there. And anyone who's visited Tibet will know, for all the beauty there, there's a kind of surly uneasiness between the Han people and the Tibetans. Now, what I haven't mentioned in all of this is what I think for an American who grows up in New England, an American whose intellectual lifeblood would be Madison and Lincoln and Martin Luther King and the Roosevelts and so forth, and that is the question of freedom and democracy in China. And I think one of the problems when Americans think about freedom and democracy is I'm reminded of the wonderful Frost poem, Two Tramps in Mud Time, where he's chopping wood. The poet is chopping wood in his backyard, and two tramps come out of the woods who are lumbermen, and Frost says that when they looked at him, he realized that they thought to themselves, except as a man handles an axe, except as a man handles an axe, they had no way of knowing a fool. And I think to some degree, Americans, when they look at other countries, are looking for certain things as indicia of democracy, which are peculiar in some ways to America. For instance, the balloons coming down at a political convention, being able to write in the president's name or a different candidate on your ballot, which most countries don't have, even democratic countries. And when we don't see those things in another country, we say, well, there's no democracy there at all. In some ways, of course, that's true, but actually, no government can be successful and survive, as no company can be successful and survive, unless it stays close to the people in different ways, feedback loops, ways to consult, ways to understand what's working and not working. And it shouldn't be any surprise that the Chinese are very good at that. They do have feedback loops, but they don't have multi-party democracy. And so, if we ask ourselves, For the average Chinese, an affluent Chinese in Shanghai, what does freedom and civil rights look like to them? Their daily freedom, their ability to marry who they want to, work where they want to, travel where they want to, build their own lives for themselves, make commercial decisions, is as complete as the freedom of any American. It's that simple. More importantly, in the last few years, they have access to courts, they can enforce contracts, they have basic procedural rights in their civil life, and that's a very important aspect to them. They don't live in fear of the knock on the door in the middle of the night. However, they don't have political civil rights of association or unfettered access to speech on the internet. They don't have the right to dissent in any meaningful way, in any loud, meaningful way. They don't have that. They don't have political electoral rights, except very locally in the townships. And of course, if we're looking for other aspects of American constitutionalism, they don't have a separation of powers. That, in some ways, is not, to me, the most worrying thing. Those of us who live in China, what we've seen as a trend over the last 5 or 6 years is a reversal of the effects of the internet. Until about 4 or 5 years ago, it was quite common in China to say, well, China doesn't have democratic mechanics, but China has an internet, and on the Weibo, on the microblogs, people can criticize, they can talk, they can form groups, and that was happening quite remarkably. But in the last 5 years, the technology and the government have caught up. If it's a cat and mouse game, the cat is definitely winning. And China now has a very nuanced, but potentially at times cruel, suppression of anyone who tries to organize civil society over the internet. At the same time, especially under Xi Jinping, there is a renewed emphasis on propaganda, which is not a dirty word in China. Propaganda is their way of saying getting out the message, and study sessions and so forth. So that's something that is quite notable right now. So in some ways, it's hard to defend democracy when you're just looking at results and you're looking at China. But I think what democracy and separation of powers is perhaps most important in addressing is it's an anti-tyranny, anti-totalitarian device, if you will. It's awfully hard to develop a tyranny or a totalitarian system if you have democracy, free press, separation of powers. And perhaps that indicates the crucial importance of America to China that no one ever realizes, and that is that if America didn't exist in the world and China had all these dynamics I was just describing, perhaps China would be much more today of a totalitarian or a tyrannous state. So in many ways, I think America is important to China for that purpose. So let's shift to America. Let's take a look at America from the Chinese point of view. What's America like as a partner these days to China? Obviously, the Chinese look at us based on our alliances, and American alliances include alliances with Japan, and to some degree, an unrepentant former enemy of China. We have alliances with Korea, which threatens China in some ways geopolitically. And of course, we're the protector of Taiwan in many ways, and the Chinese never forget that. There's something else. Until quite recently, the United States in the South China Sea, the East China Sea, the Western Pacific, from our point of view, Seventh Fleet, had a naval preeminence that was unrivaled, and we would engage, and still do engage, in very close-range surveillance of the Chinese coast. You can imagine, if you're a Chinese general, how you feel about that. And this was simply a monopoly of power, naval power and air power in that region. Now, that also provided a kind of Pax Americana for Asia, which China has benefited from enormously. So it's not definitely something that has hurt China. It hasn't hurt China. And we all know America has no particular evil intentions toward China at this point. But that's something we'll come back to in a second. But the other thing which is inescapable is that ever since really the mid-2000s, particularly since the financial crisis of 2008 and onward, there's been a tremendous loss of American prestige in Chinese leadership circles. You have to imagine that the U.S. Treasury and Goldman Sachs and others are telling the Chinese how to run their economy in the 2000s, what they should be doing, how they should analyze risk. And then the Chinese watch the American financial system come close to collapse, a huge loss of prestige. On the international front, Chinese feel double-crossed by the UN actions in Libya. They feel perplexed by Syria. I suppose in some ways feel let off the hook by accusations of American torture at Abu Ghraib. They, I'm sure, breathe easier among their secret police to know that the U.S. has detained people in Guantanamo for many years without charge. And needless to say, they take a certain fascination in what can only be described as the political mess in the United States. They also get quite worried when foreign policy gurus in the U.S. talk about containment and worry about rising powers and trade wars and Thucydides traps. And they note that, and they watch it very carefully. The Chinese study America very carefully. And finally, a friend of mine in Beijing, I wrote this down, he talked about American diplomacy as being drunken sailor diplomacy. Really, it's been quite clumsy. The pivot to Asia that Secretary Clinton announced and President Obama announced was in some ways rather clumsily done. You don't necessarily have to announce you're going to pivot to Asia, you just do it. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we negotiated with our allies, with Vietnam, with Malaysia, with Singapore, with Peru, with Chile, Japan particularly. These countries gave up a lot politically, domestically, to sign up to the TPP. Our Secretary of State Clinton at the time said it was the gold standard of trade agreements. China was not part of it. It linked the U.S. in, and then we walked away from it. It was a debacle. China says that they'd like to have a larger share in the IMF and the World Bank, the international financial structure that the U.S. has put in place after Bretton Woods, and the U.S. Congress can't approve additional U.S. funding, and therefore the voting rights aren't changed. And so we don't get them into the system that would keep them in systems that help stability in the world from our point of view. And then perhaps the most notable example is the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. The Chinese announced that they're going to create an investment bank, invite other countries into it to serve the infrastructure needs of Asia. Essentially, what they're doing is what the U.S. has said all countries should do for 50 years. And then, in a violation of our principles, we tell all of our allies not to join the bank. We tell England, Germany, Japan, Korea not to join the bank. We lobby them not to join the bank. And then they all do. And then we criticize England publicly for that. And the Chinese must look at that and they must just scratch their heads. They must just scratch their heads. It's simply diplomatic incompetence. So if you're the Chinese and you're thinking, should I partner with the United States? And we'll come to what that might mean. Some of these are question marks going on in your head. But before we get to the question of partnering, let's just restate a couple home truths which we need to keep in mind. One is that despite the occasional statements in various analyses in the United States, the Chinese government is a stable government. It is competent, it is resilient. In the Chinese people's eyes, it has a measure of legitimacy. And it's not going anywhere. There's no coming collapse of China. In terms of democracy, separation of powers, what the Chinese call critically constitutionalism, it's not going to happen. Not in our lifetimes, I don't believe. There are reasons that the Chinese party has power that it's not going to give up. A third home truth, and it's remarkable how few people think this is not a home truth, is that parity, military parity, of the naval forces and other armed forces in the Western Pacific on the coast of China, parity with the United States, at least in Asia, is absolutely inevitable. It is inevitable and it is soon. This is so obvious. Who could possibly doubt it? The problem is that so many people then confuse two words and they start talking about hegemony and dominance. And they say, will China dominate the Western Pacific? Is the U.S. hegemony being replaced by a Chinese hegemony? It's a complete non sequitur. There's absolutely no reason why, in rough terms, there cannot be parity between U.S. forces and Chinese forces in that part of the world. There has been essential parity between Russian forces and American forces in the Atlantic and the Mediterranean for 50 years. We didn't go to war because of that. And there's no particular reason to think that two destroyers or two cruisers sailing nearby each other are going to create a war between the United States and China. Resisting the occurrence of parity, now that could produce a war, but there's no particular reason to think that parity equals hegemony. I also believe that much of the loose talk, I would say, that allows scholars to write long books about the so-called Thucydides trap is quite misplaced. It's so easy to point and say, well, Germany was a rising power before World War I, or Japan a rising power before World War II, rising powers lead to war. I think people who think that way aren't actually thinking through a lot of the reasons for the analogies, whether it be racial issues in Germany or people in neighboring countries, whether it be Japan reacting to an absolute vacuum of power in Asia in the 1930s and so forth. And the last home truth is that the leverage of the United States vis-a-vis China is declining. I'm not talking about prestige, just plain leverage. As China rebalances its economy, it is less reliant on exports to the great consumer economy of the United States. As they export to the rest of the world, they're less reliant on the United States. Therefore, our economic leverage is decreasing. So when you think about partnering, you always think about what are the strengths and weaknesses of both sides of the equation. And finally, before we get to the potential for partnering, the other trend, which I think is in some ways regrettable, sad in some ways, but driven by huge forces, is what I call between China and the United States, the coming meiosis, the coming meiosis. And I had to check this, but meiosis is when a cell, obviously intimately interrelated, as the U.S. and the Chinese economies have been, and to some degree, the U.S. and Chinese geopolitical movements, almost a dance, have been for the last 30 years, that when that separates out into two different cells with different DNA, that is meiosis. Let's hope that's what meiosis is. Why am I describing that? Because more and more German companies, American companies are saying that the Chinese market, as attractive as it is and as potentially important as it is being filled with protectionism, home market advantages, language, government roles, SOEs, mean that very important sectors in China, the US and European companies will not be able to compete long term. Meanwhile, in the United States, as in Western Europe, you see a rising tide of protectionism, potentially nationalism, mercantilism, and that will drive the two markets apart. Also, the obvious disparity and dichotomy between the United States and China on internet freedom will drive our markets apart. And the political need for reciprocity will drive our markets apart. By reciprocity, I mean if they won't let us into that sector, they can't come into this sector for us. And finally, security, the concern that certain American companies are being acquired by Chinese companies for the technology in very sensitive areas. The result, I believe, is going to be a gradual separation of the US and the Chinese markets. Each will become a stronghold for their home companies, but there'll be much less joint venturing between them. So what are the implications of all this for US-China relations and partnering? First of all, what about being enemies? What about being enemies? Will this make us enemies? Well, I think there are areas in which we could be enemies, very possibly could be enemies. And if you could be an enemy with China, or for that matter, if you could be an enemy with the United States, you better decide on some peace treaties and some ceasefires, because there can't really be full-scale war in many of these areas between the United States and China without full-scale disaster. What would these areas be where we have to be careful not to become enemies? Cyber war, space war, the naval maneuvers we talked about, trade in goods as opposed to investment in technology, but trade in goods. And many people might say, what about human rights? I think that in many ways, the human rights debate between China and America is pretty much off the table. America has very little leverage over China, except at the margins. Human rights in China is a very different situation than 30 years ago. Well, if not enemies, then what about rivals and competitors? Remember, we haven't even talked about partnership yet. What about rivals and competitors? Well, here's the point. If the markets diverge, as I've mentioned, if there's this kind of meiosis that goes on, what does that mean for the United States and China? What I think it means is that we will be rivals and competitors for the markets of the rest of the world, for Africa, for Southeast Asia, for Latin America, for Europe, and no holds barred. And the interesting thing there is that state-owned enterprises within their own country have enormous advantages, which is why our two markets are separating. But that state-owned enterprise advantage is much less when you're outside your own jurisdiction. And so I think that US companies, Western European companies, can compete very effectively, should be able to compete very effectively for the tremendously exciting new societies and markets in Africa and Latin America. We may see trade blocks forming that are larger than one country, and America and China will be rivals in forming those trade blocs and forming those associations. So finally, partners. Where can China and America be partners? Well, perhaps not today or this administration, but what I think is that the U.S. should say about China's One Belt, One Road initiative, we want in, we want to do that too. We will compete for those projects. We will be side by side with you. We will compete into Pakistan. We will compete in these other countries. And about that Asian Investment Bank, we're coming in. We're joining. We'll be on the board. We will partner with you in that. And China, for the World Bank and the IMF, we want you in with a larger voting percentage. We want you next to us at these major financial structures. And this is something no one suggested, but I think it'd be very helpful in terms of our militaries, and that is, if it's piracy off the coast of Eastern Africa, if it's peacekeeping, why not the United States and China together contribute the peacekeeping forces and learn by the militaries working together much more about each other and form some of those contacts that are so important. In global financial regulation, we will have to be partners. In global health and pandemic prevention, we will have to be partners. In climate change, we will have to be partners. In anti-terrorism, and also, remarkably perhaps, in anti-hacking and even in cybersecurity, because we should be partners in the areas where we could also potentially be enemies. That would be a way to perhaps not become enemies. And in North Korea also, I think there's room for potential partnership to diffuse that situation. So lastly, are we partners? Are we enemies? Are we rivals and competitors? We're both, we're all of those, China and America. But more than anything else, I believe that China and America to each other are the criterion countries, the criterion countries. When America looks at China, they see a communitarian regime, they see an authoritarian regime, they see restricted expression, they see problems with rule of law, more rule by law, they see a non-immigrant country to many degrees, but they see also a country which does many things very well, better than we do. And when China looks at the United States and Chinese look at the United States, they see freedom of conscience, they see individualism. They don't see as much of it as they should, but they should see brotherhood. They see rule of law, they see the greatest higher education institutions in the world, and they see immigration. And so I believe that between the two countries, there will be and continue to be a very important Chinese dream, which we will all be watching as the years go by. And I think the Chinese dream will be compared to what I would call the idea of America. And I think the idea of America and the Chinese dream will be the criteria for each other, and the world will be watching both of us. And if that's a kind of partnership, then it's a kind of partnership that I think we should all welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Stephen. While we're getting questions collected, I'll take the prerogative of the chair and ask one of my own. Over the last 20 years, we've seen a lot more engagement by China with the rest of the world. A big change from the way it was the late 20th century. Was there some factor, or what are the factors that led the Chinese to decide all of a sudden that they should become part of the world community?
Sure. Well, if it's commercial engagement and the going out policy, they didn't have a lot of money until the early 2000s. They did not have a lot of money, a lot of foreign exchange reserves. Once those built up, they were in a position to go out and go on the market. The second thing, of course, is that they needed commodities drastically as their economy grew. And so they went out looking for oil and iron ore all around the world. And on a commercial level, that's what sent them out. I think on the political and diplomatic level, they started being a little bit more involved because they were involved commercially. So whether it be Sudan or Africa or Latin America, their diplomatic engagement grew after that point.
I've got a couple questions already here in sorting things through on how the Chinese actually pay for their government. I mean, is it through taxation, or do they fund their country from profits or state-owned businesses? Just how do they?
There are three basic ways. There's an income tax in China. I'm painfully aware of it. And I apologize to the U.S. government because we get a credit for what we pay in China. It basically works out as a wash. What that means is that we file our U.S. tax returns and we say, this is how much we owed. Unfortunately, we've paid it all to the Chinese government. There's a tax treaty between the two countries. Same thing would happen with the Chinese here. They have an income tax. It goes up to, topically for these days, it goes up to 45%. And much of the money comes from that, but a great deal of money in China comes from the state-owned enterprises and the dividends from them. And finally, for the localities, a lot of their money is raised by the sale of land. The cities sell land and make a lot of money from that. And that's another source of revenue.
Then there's also a growing number of questions here, and probably some others that I haven't been able to go through, on whether you could expand on this idea of potential partnerships on things like climate change or pollution problems or on internet control, et cetera. Would the Chinese be amenable to this? I mean, what is it, the U.S. that's the problem? Is it the Chinese or both of us?
Well, on climate change, of course, there's a world consensus in a way. I think we're all aware of recent developments in terms of the Paris Climate Accord. But I think that one aspect of the Chinese strategy that is quite notable is that in that area of climate change and environment, the government is significantly encouraging Chinese companies to go into green industries. We have friends in the car industry in China. They're all joint ventures, car industry, and they are pushing them very hard to go electric. Not everyone likes nuclear power, but nuclear power, at least in terms of carbon, is a very clean source of energy. And the Chinese are pushing very hard to be the ones who have the nuclear power plant that they will export to the rest of the world. So I guess that's not so much partnership, but it's certainly areas in which this country also is very interested in, and there's the potential for joint ventures. Also, I think the security issues in those areas are not the same, and therefore there'll be less resistance to joint ventures, sharing of technology, than there would be if you were talking about artificial intelligence or face recognition, that kind of thing.
I guess there were a couple of, to follow up on that a little bit, there were a couple of questions here on Chinese artificial intelligence of the Chinese and now and in the future, and whether we're likely to see the Chinese take a lead in that area.
Yes. Just recently in Wuzhen, which is not too far from Shanghai, the fifth annual, I think it's called Cyber Conference or Internet Conference, was held. The new propaganda chief, Wang Huning, who sits on the standing committee and is perhaps one of the closest advisors of Xi Jinping, gave the keynote address. Xi Jinping was broadcast in. And right after Wang Huning stood up Tim Cook of Apple, the symbolism there was not lost on people. Apple was there bowing, if you will, before the Chinese market. But more importantly, China, in terms of the development of AI, obviously has innovative scientists and engineers and quite hard-driving entrepreneurs, but they have certain basic advantages in the development of AI, and that is that the users of mobile phones in China is now almost 900 million. Something like 200 or 300 people are on fiber optics, but they're about 900 million using the internet, using mobile phones. And without the privacy laws and constraints of Western Europe and America, and also with the partnership with the government and these companies, the ability for them to experiment and develop techniques and the incentive to experiment and develop techniques is very high. And therefore, I think you're going to see China as being a leader in AI and facial recognition in a way that will be dramatic and worrying and exciting and all those things. But they have big advantages in developing that area.
A couple here on North Korea. How much real influence does China have with North Korea? Why are the Chinese unwilling to push somewhat harder on North Korea? Are they willing to push harder? How do you regard the North Korean ambitions?
Yes. Several things about Korea. Again, this is a matter of perception. When the Chinese think of Korea, they think of 1950, 51. After North Korea invaded South Korea, General MacArthur, leading the American forces, came up from Japan, and 2 years after the founding of the People's Republic, 2 years after 1949, the greatest power in the world, the only power with nuclear weapons, the power that occupied Japan, was in Korea, and the Americans, as all everyone knows from the Incheon landing and so forth, and MacArthur drove up almost to the Chinese border, talked about using nuclear weapons against China, talked about bombing inside China. It's only at that point that the Chinese came in and drove south. Mao's son was killed in the Korean War. Millions of Chinese fought in it. Hundreds of thousands died. They think of that when they think of Korea. Americans don't think of that, but the Chinese think of that. If we jump over the chaos or the intervention that could potentially result in regime change in North Korea, and we jump to the confusion that could result from that, the Chinese are worried about two things. They're worried about a unified Korea. It's an American ally. They're worried about American radar on their border, American military in the country. And they're also worried about perhaps a million or more North Koreans fleeing into China, many of them armed and many of them desperate. So they're worried about all those things. I believe that what the U.S. should do, what I've been told it may have done, is to put a piece of paper on the table in China and say, let's not talk about how regime change might happen, but if it happens and there's chaos and both of us have an interest in securing the nuclear weapons, let us agree on what it will look like afterwards. And I think that that's a kind of partnering that may be going on at, I hope it's going on, at the highest levels. About solving it, the Chinese position right now is freeze for freeze. Freeze the number of nuclear weapons, something like 20, and not yet deliverable to the United States, apparently. Perhaps freeze the missile tests. At the same time, the U.S. and South Korea would freeze their military exercises, which we're told make the North Koreans very nervous.
There's another one here on partnering with China. It relates to intellectual property rights. How can we partner with China if it does not respect intellectual property rights?
There are two aspects to that, I think. One is that as a strategic matter of leverage, because the market's so attractive to some companies, the Chinese have told Western companies coming in, if you want to come in and do this deal, you have another subsidiary, you have other technology, you must share this technology with this other company. Voluntary, but you might say under huge pressure. No one has to agree to that, but many companies are agreeing because of the leverage involved. That's not theft, that's just hard bargaining. The other aspect, of course, is theft and hacking and lack of respect. And I'm going to punt a little bit on this one because the areas in which that's most important in computers and technology and so forth, I know least about. And so I'd be very unwilling to sort of speculate. As people know, if you're talking about the history of the United States, we were, of course, 100 years ago, the greatest pirates of anything in terms of intellectual property. That's not really relevant. But the Chinese raise it. It's not relevant, but the Chinese raise it to point it out.
Another one, this one about trade. In the wake of the TPP debacle, are there any signs of a plan B? That is, do you see any signs of a U.S. economic strategy in Asia?
Well, let's just say on the plan B, it's quite exciting, I think, in a way, because I think it was 12 countries, including the United States. The 11 ex-United States, 11 not including the United States, including, by the way, Canada and Mexico, because they were all part of this, they met recently, just a couple weeks ago, and they agreed that they were going to go forward with everything that was in the TPP arrangements without the United States, and if the United States came in later, so be it. They've renamed it memorably. Instead of TPP, it's now CPTPP. That's a hard one to forget, which I think is Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. But I'm glad they've done it. And what it'll do is the structure will be there, and it'll simply be a matter of the U.S. stepping in again. I think that could be very exciting under a different political situation for the U.S. to do that. And that is a potential. Just to add one thing to that, we haven't talked about Europe at all. Western Europe, of course, is going through such difficulties. But there's the potential for the U.S. to do a trade deal with Western Europe. And the advantage there is that the Chinese use the bilateral negotiations with different European countries to break them apart and to get the best deal from each of them. If the U.S. and Western European countries were a little closer on trade, they might be able to negotiate a better situation with the Chinese. So those are two areas that might be cause for some optimism in the future, not tomorrow morning, but going forward.
Then let's move to some social issues in China, and given that your long-standing relationship there. Can you talk about the status of women in China? Are they in leadership roles, business, government, the arts?
Yes. It's not like Japan. Japan's a very different society in terms of the role of women. rather remarkably, there are no women in the top seven in China, never have been. There are very few women in the top ranks of the Communist Party. There are very few women running provinces. So that is certainly a man's club in that way. But in business and in the middle ranks of business, women are very successful. Most Chinese couples, most affluent Chinese couples in Shanghai or Beijing, if they have a child, often the child's taken care of by a grandparent while both of them work. That's quite common. And certainly women in the workplace. In my firm, we had about 100 lawyers, about 100 other staff members. The strong majority were women. The majority of the lawyers were women, and half the partners were women. So I think Chinese society is very open to that. But that doesn't mean it doesn't have some of the same dynamics, interactions that we see in our own.
Could you discuss medical care in China? Quality, availability?
First payment for medical care. Now there's medical insurance for people who work for sophisticated companies. If you're a city resident and you go to a city hospital, my understanding is most of it's paid for by that status. By virtue of your status, it's paid for. If you're a rural resident in a city hospital, you only have a third, only a third is paid by the city and the other two-thirds for you, which essentially means it's prohibited. So a rural resident with some serious illness will almost certainly go back to their locality. That's payment for it. In terms of the quality of medical care, as you can imagine, it depends what you can pay for. What a lot of people may not realize about China is whether it's education or medical care, people pay a great deal for special treatment to get the best treatment, and they have to pay to get it, often in addition to what are the standard rates.
I know when I worked with the Russians, or the Soviet Union, a lot of the doctors were women. And I always thought, gee, you know, the medical profession is well respected here. Then I found out that the medical profession was not as well respected there, and so women went into that. Is it similar in China?
Very, very similar in the sense of it's very difficult to be a doctor in China. If you're a doctor at a hospital, I think you get paid very little, officially paid very little. I think it's a terribly grueling profession for them in China, very grueling.
And this one is on food security. What is the status of Chinese food and energy security?
We joke about some things in China. We joke about cadmium in the rice. We have friends who visit us in China who won't eat the fish because they visited a fish farm. There are all these issues because much of the land and the water is polluted. There was a time a few years ago when pigs started floating down the Huangpu River past the skyscrapers of Shanghai, not dozens and hundreds of pigs, but thousands of pigs floating belly up. They apparently had been injected with cyanide or something like that to make their flesh rosy red when you were selling it. A few weeks later, we were in a store in Shanghai buying some pork, and I just said, I just hope this isn't river pork, because we wouldn't want to eat that. So, we're joking about it. There's been some terrible tragedies. There was a substance put into milk powder to raise the protein testing of it that was killing and causing kidney damage, particularly in children. Horrible things like that, sometimes covered up. So the Chinese are particularly worried about that. And that for that reason, New Zealand milk companies do very well in China. People will buy New Zealand milk because they know it's pure and fresh and has been tested.
Just a general question. What do you believe is the greatest misperception that Americans have regarding China, both the government and the people? Where do we really get it wrong?
Well, depends if you're talking about people who've never been there and just talk about China for perhaps domestic political purposes here. I think a misperception might be, as I referred to earlier, is that people somehow don't have freedom to organize their own lives. I think that if people believe that, that is a deep misperception about China. I think a second misperception, a kind of hopeful one in many quarters, is that somehow China is just one economic downtick from widespread public uprisings, that as soon as the economy is growing less than 6%, people will rise up, or that as people get more affluent, they will demand democratic institutions that we're familiar with. I think those are probably not going to happen in China.
And just one final question. This is probably the most important question I've asked today. It's about wine. Are the Chinese likely to become the world's most avid wine drinkers and growers and to grow the wine they seem to love?
I was looking to Yorkshi, my wife, for the answer. Once the Chinese believed that red wine was healthy to drink, I think the amount of red wine consumed in China went up enormously. They produce a lot of wine, huge amounts of, I think, of grape juice turned into wine. I don't know that any are particularly good, but they certainly think it's a good thing to have and to drink.
Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.